The BioRevolution Podcast.
Your hosts,
Luise von Stechow
and Andreas Horchler. From animals to algorithms, how AI brings drug testing closer to human biology. This episode's title of the BioRevolution Podcast. Welcome, Izzy.
Welcome.
So today, without a guest, because we have an intense dialogue.
Well, let's see how intense it's going to get. But
yeah, I guess so. Ethics involved, of course, but practicalities as well.
Yeah.
And maybe groundbreaking new science when it comes to replacing animal testing, all that in this episode. But as always, we start with quotes. What did you bring?
I brought a couple of quotes because I think it's a pretty broad topic that we're discussing today. So how can we replace, reduce animal testing with the use of artificial intelligence? One of the quotes comes from Gemma Davis from Animal Free Research UK. She was quoted in a recent article in The Lancet that came out just the other week. So we're February 2026. What she says is experimenting on animals causes pain and suffering. This becomes an especially hard pill to swallow when you realize that in many cases, the experiments do not translate into benefits for humans. And this, I think, is the basic premise of what we're going to discuss today. When is it really warranted to use animals in testing drugs and testing hypotheses for humans if they are not really translatable? This is what we're going to get into. The other part comes from Karen Blythe, quoted in the same article. She's a professor of in vivo cancer biology at the Cancer Research UK Scotland Institute in Glasgow. And she says, our options for fully understanding metabolism in anything other than a living mammalian model are still very limited. Mm-hmm. Again, something we're going to get into. If we replace models, how can we really capture physiology in holistic fashion? And the last one I want to quote is not a person, but an agency, the FDA in the United States, who in a recent roadmap to phase out animal testing for specific drug classes says, in the long term, 3 to 5 years, that long term, FDA will aim to make animal studies the exception rather than the norm for preclinical safety and toxicity testing, which is a pretty bold statement. And
absolutely,
if this is realistic, I think is what we want to discuss today.
Yeah, absolutely. So to know the lay of the land, it does make an awful lot of sense to dig into history a little bit, because animal testing hasn't been something that has been around forever, but for quite a long time. And how did this all get going?
Animal testing has been around for a while since humans have discovered that they want to study biology and that it's not, first of all, ethically possible to do that in humans in many cases, and that it's also not always feasible to do this in models. And then studying, for example, behaviors, but also studying responses to certain compounds in animals was seen as a proxy to better understand what would happen in a human situation. And I mean, we talk about animal research now in a very broad sense. There are many different ways of animal research, of course. There's academic research that really studies only like fundamental biology, really trying to understand the biology in a translatable fashion for humans, but also sometimes really just understanding how a certain type of animal would behave, what kind of physiology this animal has, and so on. But there's also the type of animal research that is done mostly in the context of drug discovery and development. And there it's really about two things: understanding if a certain compound, a certain therapeutic, is safe for humans to use. So we want to find out before we move it into a clinical study, before we want to test it in humans, that it will not cause harm in these humans. The other thing is that we also want to be at least to an extent certain that it will have any effect, because otherwise it would be an experiment that's kind of wasted and that would be ethically even more questionable. But that wasn't always the case. And in general, the idea that you have a regulation of which drugs you can give to people, that is, well, not rather a new concept, but about like 100 years ago, that was not really common. It was not regulated in that sense. You could just sell anything and say like, this works and it's safe. good luck with it. And I think a really big shift came with the thalidomide scandal. This is something in Germany that we know as Contagan. This
right.
was one of the most famous drug safety scandals in the 20th century, where a compound that was sold as a cure or as a treatment for morning sickness in pregnant women actually turned out to be embryotoxic or teratogenic and causing, it's only embryotoxic, not teratogenic, I think, but it caused birth defects in thousands of children in Europe. And that actually instigated this idea that things need to be tested thoroughly before they are given to people, and that they should be also tested thoroughly in animals before they enter clinical studies. And there is this two species idea that you test in at least two species. This is mostly a rodent, a mouse or a rat, mm-hmm. and then often also a slightly bigger animal whose physiology is closer to the human one. So this is mainly dogs or pigs, mini pigs, for example. If we talk about biologics, so antibodies, gene therapies and the like, then often they are also tested in monkeys, non-human primates, because certain features, for example, the immune system that can be triggered by these types of compounds is very different, for example, in rodents and also not close enough in other species like dogs or pigs. So we need like a model that's even closer to us to predict Absolutely. This kind of toxicity. So historically speaking, there is a good reason protecting humans from harmful effect of drugs. And also only, so, I mean, safety is the one thing. The other thing is also that we want to have a rather good hypothesis that something actually works, especially if we think about, for example, cancer. If we would test a new treatment in patients, we want to have at least an inkling that it will have a benefit for them. Otherwise, it would really not make sense to give people who we want to cure of a disease a new type of treatment.
Mm-hmm. So even the quotes at the very beginning hinted to the side where it, in cases, doesn't make 100% sense.
In many cases, it makes no sense at all.
Okay.
So it's not...
So, fair enough.
Yeah. Mice have a very different metabolism. They have a very different
right.
brain. They have a very different immune system. They have a very different behavior and a very different lifespan than humans.
Yeah.
I mean, this is very clear, right? So mice don't naturally develop many of the types of cancers that we have. They don't develop, for sure, the same types of neurodegenerative diseases.
Mm.
They don't develop type 2 diabetes in the way that we do. They're just very different. So if we want to study if something is efficacious in these models, we need to artificially induce these kind of diseases in the mice. And for cancer, this is very common. And this is also a very common saying if you look at biotech investor decks and they have like really great response rates. And then people are, yeah, great, you cured cancer in mice.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you artificially implant a tumor, often not even from a patient-derived cell line, but really right. just like a laboratory cell line, which has its own flaws, let's put it like that.
Right.
You implant that in a mouse whose immune system needs to be reduced to even accept this. So again, you make the situation further artificial. This is, of course, very far from a naturally developing disease in humans.
Right.
That said, there are also mouse models for developing cancer in a more, let's say, natural disease course. But this takes a lot of time and makes it more expensive, makes it less reliable, and also less likely for drugs to show an effect. So I think there is a little bit of a vicious circle of course, wanting to see results. It's not something that I'm criticizing. It's just mm-hmm. kind of the way this type of experiment works. And the question is really, how well does this translate to humans? And in many cases, it actually doesn't translate that well.
Yeah.
And cancer is still something that has, let's say, a higher chance of translating, I think, than, for example, anything that is related to neurodegenerative mm-hmm. or psychiatric diseases. Because, I mean, mice just don't get depressed. Or yeah. not in the same... Yeah. I can't even imagine that they do get depressed, but I think it's in a very, very different way than humans. So testing...
Maybe there's no such thing as dementia or Alzheimer's or
something. At least not... Definitely not in the same way. So I think the learnings that we can take away about a disease and about treating the disease from these animal models is really very limited. And therefore, I think here we really need to ask the question, and this is also something that people are doing, of course, already for a long time, how much do we want to even rely on these models that don't tell us anything?
Right.
Because I think there are two things. I mean, what you said in the beginning, it's about ethics. So we want to, of course, spare elm alive as much as possible. There's this 3R principle, replace, reduce, refine, where, I mean, get rid of the animals as much as possible, if not limit the number of animals, if not try to treat them as good as possible. Yeah. So really weigh the options of using animals in each and every experiment that you're doing. And if it doesn't tell you anything useful from an ethical standpoint, I think you should really try to avoid it.
Yeah.
But there is another reason, which is the financial standpoint, that, I mean, first of all, you spend a lot of money on these animal experiments, which might maybe for mouse experiments not be that expensive, but for bigger animals and especially for non-human primate studies that are done for antibody development, this is, becomes really, really expensive.
Yeah.
So it needs to tell us something meaningful in order to warrant this investment. I mean, this is one part. And the even worse part is what you said, I mean, this translation gap, which, I mean, we know and we talked about it many times on this podcast, the average industry rate of success from a drug entering clinical development to making it to the market is around 90%, sometimes less. Some other estimates, maybe a bit more, depends very much, of course, on the type of compound, on the disease area, etc. But you can say almost everything fails. I think that would be a very simple way to put it. And one of the reasons why almost everything fails is because the models on which we make the decision, is it worth it to put something into the clinic, don't tell us enough. And this is, of course, something where we really need to become better, because this really wastes a lot of money. And there's also a question of ethics there. If the industry wastes money on hypotheses that are not prone to play out, you deprive patients of better options. Because, I mean, in the end, what the pharma industry is there for is to bring innovative treatments to patients, to cure disease or to better manage many of the diseases that we're facing today. And every failed program takes away from other better hypotheses. So really, it's a trade-off to try to make the best decisions possible. Yeah. On the one hand, of course, to stay financially viable, but also on the other hand, to really, follow the mission of getting new drugs out there for patients. So I think there is really the crux in this animal testing model, that we are relying very much on models that might not tell us the right things. And this is really now speaking more for the drug development side of things. There is, of course, also the academic research part of things, where you're testing basic hypotheses. And there, I would say, and this also goes a little bit with the second quote that I read, so it's a little bit the question, what are we trying to study? Because if we want to study, for example, behavior, this becomes very hard in a model that is not has no body. So how do you study a bodily response to something that doesn't have a body? Of course you can, and I can imagine that this could be something that you can model that with AI eventually, but at the current stage, AI models are extremely reductionist, and they are really studying mostly, and now we're starting to see a little bit bigger foundation models that include various parameters, but in most cases the models that work well are very focused on one single parameter. And this is also the tricky part, right, of human biology and disease biology and drug development. It's very hard to predict what's going to happen, because you have heterogeneity between people. You have a super complex interconnected system, and you test something in a very, like, we have one small answer, but we would need maybe a million answers to be sure. And I think there is really an opportunity for AI to help us finding better and more answers, and also help us ask the right questions before we put things into clinical development.
And the interesting part is that a huge portion, a huge chunk of what you've been explaining now has been known for a while.
Yeah.
And the industry's wish to tackle those problems has been there for a while as well. And so the approaches are, in my understanding, please correct me if I'm wrong, in vitro, in silico, and hybrid.
Yeah. And I think...
Can we dig into that a little
bit? I think, I mean, in silico is anything that is AI, algorithms, computational, so anything that doesn't, no wet lab. And then, in vitro would be anything that's not organismic, but in the lab. This combination, I think, really does make a lot of sense. So what the agencies, so the FDA phasing out animal strategy in the UK and on the European level, what they all stress are these NAMs, the new approach methodologies. Some people also say non-animal methodologies, but I think that the first one is the more accepted term to use. And these are just replacement models, and they work on many different levels. So it could just really be a cell experiment. But there are many sophisticated types of these models now coming up, and many of them are so-called organs on chips, patients on chips, where you grow out a little organ, like a liver, kidney, something else, even heart, little brain on a chip. That's, of course, you cannot imagine that you have a fully formed liver there, but you have a piece of tissue that would contain different cell types that interact in the liver, and that, if it's a sophisticated model, also are hooked up to some type of circulation that comes just through tubing. So you simulate in a dish kind of what the organ would behave like. And then you sometimes even have multiple of these organs linked together with fake circulation.
So a lab body at the end of the day.
Exactly. And this is this patient on chip idea. And I think this is, of course, very promising, because you have a little bit of the complexity that you need, but you also have it's reductionist enough to be able to ask more simple questions. And it has two huge advantages. And one of them is that you can use human cells for it. And I think one of the big problems, of course, of animal experiments is that you use a model that's not a human. And the promise of these NAMs and of using AI could be that we just base our decision making more on human data. So our prediction of what would happen then in a real patient can be more close to reality.
Absolutely.
And the second thing, and that is something that I find really exciting, and that I think a couple of biotechs are already doing, and having some big pharma partnerships on that, are using patient-specific xenografts. So growing out using from different patient cells, differentiating them, and then growing out these organ chips or patient chips. And that is, of course, really interesting for capturing the heterogeneity between patients, because this is, again, something that we're really lacking often in these animal studies. And I mean, if we imagine like these early studies, we're also not talking about hundreds or thousands of animals. We're talking about like 10, 50, 100 mice or something,
which
are very, very close genetically, and mostly also having only one sex in there, again, to not make it more. Everything is very simplified in these models.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I mean, we do that to get simpler answers. But this also leads sometimes to problems later on, because the answer was too simple. And I think we need to find a trade-off between being reductionist enough so we can have some decision matrix, because, I mean, biology is so complex that it's just very hard to make decisions based on it. And that's something that we know. But at the same time, also be complex enough that we capture these rare events, that we capture the heterogeneity sufficiently. And I think one of the simple topics simple examples of that we talked about a lot, where again we have been too reductionist in clinical research involving humans, is this huge gap of clinical research where no females were used in trials.
Yes.
Actually, also due to thalidomide. That was the trigger, because you realize that if there is embryotoxic and teratogenic compounds out there, a chance that you have someone in the study who might be pregnant would be really bad. So therefore, but of course, the reasons are always understandable, but the outcomes are, of course, that there are a number of approved drugs that have in clinical trials never been tested in women, which is not what we want. So capturing the heterogeneity is something that with these NAMs, we could just use cells from different individuals, different genetic backgrounds, different sex, different age, etc., and see if there's actually differences that can be captured. And something that could be really interesting, and we talk a lot in this podcast about rare diseases, right? And there you always think, I mean, this has a genetic cause, so all of the patients are the same because it's rare and you have a gene and you know, like, okay, this is all the same. But this is really not true, that you have even in the same disease, for example, cystic fibrosis, where it's the same gene involved, you have so many different mutations that have very, very different phenotypes. So even though it's rare and even though it has the same cause, the phenotype of these patients differs very significantly. So capturing that by using patient-specific cells to test new compounds, for example, gene therapies, would be super interesting. Absolutely. In that case. And of course, there is something where AI can come in and integrate all this data that is generated with the NAMs. And I think there's another thing that these hybrid models, as you say, so linking in vitro and in silico together can really be very powerful because, I mean, and we talk about that a lot, the problem with AI is, of course, that we don't have the good training data.
Right,
we lack high-quality training data. We have tons of data in biomedical research, but it's unfortunately not of the quality that we need to train the models. And this promise that I just outlined, so training things on human data or having better understanding of human biology, of course, requires us to train it on human data. And all these experiments have, of course, traditionally been done in animals. So we need the human data in order to better to better capture that. And here, I think the NAMs can be a great bridging
technology,
to even produce data, to train the models, and it becomes kind of this virtuous cycle where you, I mean, at some point also could probably have this in a fully robotic fashion, so have optimized labs, something that a number of companies are already doing, Recursion, Turbine, many others, so investing in these kind of really autonomous labs where the robots carry out the experiments, data is produced, used to train the AI suggests new experiments. Somewhere there's a little human in the loop and says, yeah, makes sense, doesn't make sense. But having this cycle of data generation and training of the AI model can, of course, be extremely beneficial because you have high-quality data and you can answer very specific questions.
Yeah.
And I think here we also have the chance to, and this is something that I said in the beginning, with the animal experiments, we often answer one question, or maybe we answer 10 questions.
Right.
But we should answer
and there you can
a
go
thousand.
Bulk. Yes, absolutely.
Or maybe a million questions.
Sure.
And we can scale the number of endpoints, the number of questions that we ask. Mm-hmm. We can scale that really massively using these technologies. Mm-hmm. And of course, we can de-risk much more using this and understanding better how would this compound really affect human biology, what kind of toxicity would it potentially cause in different individuals. Mm-hmm. Because what we also know, and this is something that we are also often struggling to capture, and what is one of the main reason why approved drugs have to be withdrawn are toxicities.
Yeah.
Cardiotoxicity, but very commonly also liver toxicity. Mm. And the problem is that there are these rare, sometimes idiosyncratic liver toxicities that you just don't capture in the animal studies because you have too few. I mean, per se, even you could capture it in the animal studies, but you only tested 20 or 50 rats and you would have needed 500 to capture it. Mm. And then again, in the clinical study, you had only 500 patients and you would have needed 550 to statistically see it.
Yeah.
Then if it's a drug that's used in many, many people, you might still get high enough rate of people who have some genetic background, have some co-infection, have something in their biology that makes them or take another medication that reacts with this one and that then have these rare liver events. And capturing these things earlier would be really beneficial. And again, also having a more patient-specific understanding, does that actually work and is it actually safe? So I think here we really have a lot of opportunities for using AI and for using these new approach methodologies. Mm-hmm.
Two quick ones to wrap this up.
Yeah.
First off, what is your impression? What is the feedback both of policymakers and the industry? You mentioned a few, and also, of course, the bold statement made by the FDA at the very beginning in the quote. What do you expect? Is this really going to take off right now rapidly?
So one thing that I need to say on the FDA statement is that this was on monoclonal antibodies, not on all drugs, so a specific type of drug. I do not think that it's realistic to do that in 3 to 5 years. Mm. I think we are really not there. I think everything that I said is at the stage of huge potential and pilots that are done in biotechs and in pharma, but they are for at least more sophisticated understanding. So not just predicting with more simple models toxicity, not validated enough for us to really decide if we can trust it. And right. I think for animal studies, there's a really long legacy of a common understanding of where we say this is correct. We trust this because the animal showed it. Yeah. And it's...
has to be seen in major papers, right? Yeah.
And it's possible to replace that. There are, for example, chemical irritation tests that used to be done in rabbits, and it was shown by US researchers that this can work better with AI or with computational models. And now this really completely reduced the use of rabbits for these tests, and the models are being used. So it's definitely possible. But I think the transition period will be really hard because we are still in a stage, and there is, for academic research, people are still really believing also in a paper is worth more if there is animal research involved because it's the model that really shows that something works. And then really stepping away from that, I think, will take a mindset shift. But there is also a huge question of financial incentives for it because, I mean, the problem is that the animal facilities, they are set up, they are running. Nothing needs to be done. Changing this to new approach methodologies will require massive investments and will require training staff and will require having a common understanding of what that actually means. And I think here the agencies, I mean, really also need to step it up and say, what does success look like and how can we qualify these type of models in order to really be on the same page about if we can trust them? Because at the current stage, I would say this is really hard to say, can we trust these models? Everyone who publishes this and who has the develops that in their biotech will say it works and it will work in their hands, but we need something that's comparable between different approaches and between different vendors, between different labs, just to be sure that we can trust it as much as the animal models. And that said, I mean, the animal models for sure aren't perfect, and we lined that out, I think, in the beginning very well. These models currently are also not perfect. So we are going to replace an imperfect model with another one, and we need to somehow make decisions where we see...
making the new model a little more perfect.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And I think there is a huge payoff, and I think part of that is really the ethical payoff, because I think it's great not to torture animals. And I mean, I'm not saying that in a way that researchers on purpose harm animals, but every experiment puts stress on the animal. They don't do not want to live under these conditions, and everything that's being done to them will cause them distress. I mean, this is very clear even under the most perfect conditions.
I wanted to close on that note, actually, because, of course, we didn't extensively talk about the ethics aspect because there are so many other things at stake. And, of course, there could be a comparison between animal testing and the meat industry, for instance, and then we would produce very, very different numbers, for instance. Yeah. I'm not saying this is a collateral damage, but it is something that we are on the road of getting rid of, right?
Yeah, and this is always the question, right, that people bring up with the how can you criticize animal experimentation if you're not a vegetarian or something. Yeah. I think these types of whataboutism don't really lead you anywhere. No. I think this is not weighing the value of a live animal or human is always a very tricky ethical debate that I think, I mean, the researchers luckily don't need to decide, but the policymakers need to decide and need to give the researchers the frameworks in which to decide. And I think it's great that this is really moving. At the same time, I mean, we also need to be aware that we, as you say, I mean, the amount of animal experiments that are being done for biomedical research are negligible in terms of the numbers of procedures that are being done in other industries. Right. That said, I mean, this is, it's a weighing, right? And I think every life counts in a sense, and you need to just make your, I think, as a consumer, make your decisions, as a regulator, make the decisions, and as a scientist, also make the decisions, I think, maybe on a personal level. So, for example, for me, it was really a decision to not do a certain type of research because I didn't want to do the animal experiments and I didn't want to work with monkeys because, for me personally, this did not feel right. I'm not criticizing that other people are doing it because I understand that they get valuable results out of it, but I could not do it. So I think it's really, it's a very tough debate. And I think the, as many things that we discussed, there's a lot of gray zone that we need to be very sensitive of when we discuss these things. And I think this, as I said, this whataboutism options to say, yeah, but if you do this, you cannot criticize this. That's too simple. I think
it is. Yeah.
We really need to make smart decisions here. And the cool thing about it is it's not only a payoff on an ethical sense, but it's a payoff, I mean, in the end, hopefully, for the industry to be more efficient, make more money, but especially also for patients to get better drugs.
Yes.
And that would be great.
Many, many thanks, Izzy.
Thank you.
Opportunities down the road. This is a fascinating field, and we have to readdress this in one fashion or the other, I think.
Absolutely.
This was the BioRevolution podcast for this time. I hope you enjoyed the show. Further information, as always,
science-tales.com, T-A-L-E-S.
Please feel free to add your comments. Encourage us to discuss one or the other topic. Thank you again, Izzy.
Thank you.